Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Rajdeep Singh, the Director of Law and Policy at the Sikh Coalition. Mr. Singh has a background in bank regulation and also holds a law degree from William & Mary. In addition to bank regulation, he has written on issues of religious regulation, including, quote, the application of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to appearance regulations that presumptively prohibit observant Sikh lawyers from joining the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General Corps, unquote, in the Chaplain Law Review. And that could possibly be the longest title I've ever read on this podcast. But he also wrote a shorter titled article called How State Photo Identification Standards Can Be Used to Undermine Religious Freedom, published in the Asian American Law Journal at UC Berkeley School of Law. But Raj does not just approach these issues from the eyes of a scholar, as he is also someone who has been on the front line of religious liberty battles in recent years and was instrumental in overturning an 87-year-old Oregon law that prohibited public school teachers from wearing religious dress. And he also helped advocate for historic equal employment opportunity legislation in California that protects religious observers from workplace segregation. In working with various branches of government, including Congress and the White House, he has also spearheaded efforts to expand federal hate crime tracking. And if that wasn't enough, he also promotes interfaith dialogue as a staff member at the Sikh Coalition and has appeared on numerous radio and television programs and has written articles in the Washington Post and New York Times. I found him through a book chapter in Alan Hertzky's edited volume, Religious Freedom in America, a book that we will link to. And I will also link to Mr. Singh's full biography, The Sikh Coalition, and a few other interesting tidbits on our website. So please stop by and visit us. Raj, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
I have to ask you about that title of the Chapman Law Review piece that I cited there a little bit earlier. How can you even put that on a curriculum vitae? It's so long. And did anybody stop and say, hey, you got to shorten this title a little bit?
No, there was no resistance. I just used two or three lines to fit it in to a CV.
Wow. Yeah, lawyers, they got those long, huge titles of stuff. So, but it is definitely very descriptive, and you're dealing with lots of issues today dealing with religious liberty, and that's going to be one of the topics of conversation here. But I want to start our conversation with some background on the Sikh religion and the Sikh population here in America, because I'm going to fully admit that I am relatively unfamiliar with that religion and that community, and I'm guessing that many of our listeners are as well. So give us some background, if you can, upon the Sikh faith and the community.
Sure. So the Sikh religion was founded over 500 years ago in the Punjab region of South Asia by Guru Nanak. Guru Nanak was born in 1469, and he lived during a time of tremendous social turmoil and political turmoil in India. India was invaded and subsequently conquered by the Mughal Empire, and at the same time, countless Indians were being oppressed in the name of the caste system and gender inequality. And there was a lot of sort of religious intolerance and social upheaval in India at that time. So that was the context in which Guru Nanak lived. And what he did was he tried to emphasize the oneness of God and the oneness of humanity. And his core message was that there is one God and that all human beings are equal, not just in terms of their dignity, but also in terms of their divinity, regardless of their race, regardless of their religion, in the context of India, regardless of their caste. And I think in the context of contemporary struggles, even with respect to gender. So Guru Nanak was a proponent of equal rights, religious freedom, religious pluralism, gender inequality, centuries before the American Revolution and the Bill of Rights. And I often joke with people, I say that Sikhs are among the most American of Americans, because ideas about religious freedom, ideas about universal equality, are in the Sikh DNA. Now, Guru Nanak was followed by 9 successor gurus who elaborated on his message over the course of more than 2 centuries. And unfortunately, Sikhs were persecuted because of their beliefs and because of the teachings of the gurus. Our 5th guru, Guru Arjan, for example, was arrested and executed by the Mughal Empire because they saw him as a threat, and they saw the growing Sikh religious movement as a threat to their authority and to their power. The 9th Sikh guru, Guru Tegh Bahadur, was arrested and executed by the Mughal Empire around 1675 because he actually spoke out in favor of religious freedom on behalf of Hindus, people who he did not share a religion with, people with whom he had religious disagreements, but who were people nonetheless. And when a group of Hindus approached him for help to confront the Mughals in the face of persecution, Guru Tegh Bahadur actually sacrificed his life and really was a forerunner in the cause of religious freedom, not just for Sikhs, but for all people. The 10th guru, Guru Gobind Singh, who is the last living guru of the Sikhs, is responsible for giving shape to the Sikh identity. Observant, devout Sikhs are instantly recognizable by their articles of faith. Observant Sikhs wear turbans and are also distinguished by articles of faith which they wear on their body. And Guru Gobind Singh was responsible for creating a fellowship of devout Sikhs called the Khalsa in 1699. The Khalsa fellowship is open to all Sikh men and women, and initiates into this order are required to uphold the highest ideals of the Sikh religion. They live a highly disciplined life, and apart from wearing turbans, are required to maintain uncut hair and wear other religious articles that signify or express Sikh religious values, including the importance of leading an ethical life, the importance of standing up against oppression, and striking a balance between living a spiritual life and living the life of a householder in the context of having a family and living in the world rather than renouncing it. Sikhs, following the death of Guru Gobind Singh, were brutally persecuted by the Mughals and were nearly driven to extinction because of the severity and brutality of the persecution. But they bounced back and established their own sovereign empire between 1799 and 1849 under the leadership of a Sikh monarch, Maharaja Ranjit Singh. His kingdom was the last to be annexed by the British following his death in 1849. And under the British colonial rule, Sikhs actually initially played a disproportionately sort of loyal role in the Allied cause. So you saw thousands of Sikhs volunteering to fight with the Allies in both world wars under the British banner. But eventually Sikhs also became sort of the leading proponents of independence and freedom from the British later in the colonial era. And in fact, a majority of the Indians who either were arrested or exiled or executed by the British for supporting independence were Sikhs. Some estimates are that you know, between 70 and 75% of all of the people who were either arrested, imprisoned, or executed by the British were Sikhs for fighting in the independence movement. After the independence of India in 1947, you, for the first time, began to see a proliferation of Sikhs throughout the world. You had asked about Sikh Americans. You know, the first Sikhs actually migrated to the United States at the turn of the 20th century, around the last decade of the 19th. But the Sikh population was always very, very small in the United States at that time because of restrictive and racist immigration laws. As you know, Congress passed a series of immigration laws in the early part of the 20th century that effectively halted immigration from Asia. And as a result, the Sikh population of the United States was estimated to be no more than 1,500 until the latter part of the 20th century. And in fact, it wasn't really until 1965 Lyndon Johnson, Immigration Nationality Act, liberalizing immigration, that you started to see more Sikh migration from India to the United States. And as of now, the best estimates are that there are no more than 500,000, half a million Sikhs in the United States, pursuing all kinds of professions and walks of life. And my organization, the Sikh Coalition, was founded after 9/11, in response to an avalanche of backlash, violence, and discrimination against Sikhs following the September 11th attacks. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of ignorance in the United States about Sikhs, why Sikhs wear turbans. There's a lot of conflation with anti-American terrorists in the Middle East and in Afghanistan who also wear turbans. And so we're working to mitigate some of these challenges through the legal process. As you pointed out, we've been involved in a number of advocacy campaigns to promote religious freedom and equal employment opportunity. We're also active with efforts to combat hate crime, school bullying, and racial, religious, and other invidious forms of profiling. And as of now, there are about 25 million Sikhs throughout the world. Most of them are still in India, in Punjab, in the northwest part of India. But there are also sizable populations of Sikhs in Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and really every continent of the world. So I'll stop there. I know I've been rambling at you, but that was sort of a brief history of Sikhs from 1469 to the present.
Oh, it's a great history, in fact. And I want to come back to some of the articles of clothing and other types of religious displays of faith, because that is going to become important with respect to understanding religious freedom issues here. But I'm interested in the Sikh American population here in the United States. As you mentioned, after 1965, immigration picks up. Are there any places in the United States that they tend to be concentrated? Are they dispersed equally across different places? And basically, in terms of the general demographic characteristics, how do they compare to the quote-unquote typical American, if I can use the word typical American, in terms of education, professions, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so the first Sikh migrants to the United States who arrived in the very sort of tail end of the 19th century settled on the west coast of the United States, Washington State, where you are, Oregon, California. And there was also a sizable population of Sikhs at that time in Vancouver. And in fact, outside of India today, the largest concentration of Sikhs anywhere in the world is in Vancouver, around Surrey and British Columbia. But if you're talking about the United States, the legacy of those early Sikh migrants is a very, very large Sikh population in California. There are no sort of reliable estimates of the number of Sikhs in California, but there are large numbers of them, perhaps as many as 250,000 throughout the state, mainly concentrated in the Central Valley. So you're talking about Fresno, Yuba City, Stockton, also the Bay Area near San Francisco. Fremont has a very significant Sikh population. There is also a significant population of Sikhs in New York City, in Queens. It's probably not as large as the Sikh population of California, but nowhere near as large as the California Sikh population, but it is substantial. And the way we could tell is by, you know, figuring out how many Sikh gurdwaras or Sikh houses of worship there are in any given state or city. Apart from those two population centers, California and New York, there are small but not insubstantial Sikh populations throughout the country. Most major cities have at least one gurdwara, which signifies that there is a Sikh presence.
But, what does that term mean? Is that the house of worship? Is that a individual who's the leader of the community? What is that?
No, the gurdwara is the name of the building,
okay.
The Sikh house of worship. Gurdwara literally means house of the guru. And, you know, the concept of a guru, and I know that word has been anglicized now, and it you know, means a whole bunch of other things now, you know, like a finance guru or a fitness guru or a health guru or whatever.
Dr. Phil.
No, the word, that's right. The word guru actually is of Indian derivation, and it means enlightener, a teacher. And the word Sikh actually means student. And so there's this recurring theme in the Sikh tradition where you have the prophets of the religion who are addressed as gurus, and their disciples are known as students or Sikhs. And so a gurdwara, the house of worship for Sikhs, literally means the house of the guru. And the Sikh scripture is called the Guru Granth Sahib. The Guru Granth Sahib is a compilation of hymns composed by the Sikh gurus, which also includes the compositions of Hindu and Muslim saints who were contemporaries of the Sikh gurus in medieval India. The scripture is organized musically in accordance with the musical scales of Indian classical music. They're called ragas. And there's a great deal of emphasis in the Sikh religious tradition on music and musical worship as an approach to God. And the final living guru, Guru Gobind Singh, prior to his death and his passing in 1708, declared that the eternal guru, or teacher, or enlightener of the Sikhs, would no longer be a human being. It would be our scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib. So every gurdwara has in it a copy of the Sikh scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib. And I should add that every Sikh gurdwara is distinguished by four doors, entrances, signifying openness to all of humanity, regardless of what corner of the world you're coming from. And anyone, regardless of their religion, regardless of their social status, regardless of their background at all, is welcome to visit a Sikh gurdwara. And, you know, what you'll find there is a copy of our scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib. Hymns from the Guru Granth Sahib are recited and also sung in musical measure with musical instruments at a gurdwara. And then after a service, there is a free meal, which is prepared by a volunteer kitchen, which is attached to every gurdwara. And so there's a great deal of emphasis in Sikhism on openness, pluralism, equality, you know, insisting that people break bread together, eat together, sit together, serve each other in this voluntary kitchen setting. And really the focus of the worship is on devotional hymns, singing of devotional hymns from our scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib.
And what can you tell us about the demographics of the Sikh community in terms of education, professions, and other things like that? Because I think there are some stereotypes out there that are somewhat insidious, but give us a indication of who we are talking about when we talk about the Sikh population.
I think in general, Sikhs are among the most enterprising people in the world. Most of the early migrants from India to the United States around the 1890s were actually Sikhs. And I think that tells you something about their character. These are people who fearlessly decided to leave their homes to create a better future for themselves and their families before anybody else did from the subcontinent. Sikhs were disproportionately represented in the Indian freedom movement. Despite being 2% of India's population, Sikhs comprise something like 70 to 75% of all people who were either arrested, exiled, or executed by the British for struggling for freedom. And that tells you something about their character. So in general, I would say that Sikhs are very entrepreneurial, very enterprising. They tend to do very well in any profession that they pursue. And in the United States, presently, Sikhs are represented in all walks of life. So there are Sikh professionals, you know, physicians, lawyers, entrepreneurs, and so on. But there are also Sikhs who own small businesses. They drive taxis. They own convenience stores. They're heavily represented in the trucking industry. In general, you will very, very rarely find a Sikh who refuses to work, because in the Sikh religious tradition, there's a great deal of emphasis on earning an honest living by your own labor. And in India, it's often said that you'll never find a Sikh beggar, because Sikhs, regardless of the job they're given, will always prefer to work rather than to beg. And overall, Sikhs are doing okay in the United States. There is a lot of income inequality, as with the rest of society, but if you're just talking about, you know, the character of Sikhs, I would say Sikhs are extremely entrepreneurial, very self-reliant, and generally extremely productive members of society.
I want to return to the issue of the articles of faith, and there are some very visible ones that identify the Sikh community, namely the turban. Discuss the theological importance of that, of the not cutting of the hair, and then any other articles of faith. What is the importance theologically of these things? Because again, I think this is going to become very relevant when we start talking about some of these religious liberty cases.
Right. So the Sikh articles of faith are tied to the creation of the Khalsa. The Khalsa is a fellowship of devout Sikhs that was established by our 10th Guru, Guru Gobind Singh, in the spring of 1699 on the occasion of Vaisakhi. And I need to sort of explain the context of that event and give you a bit of background about Sikh history and the development of the Sikh religion. I did mention earlier at the top of this discussion that Guru Nanak was born and lived in the context of a lot of social and political turmoil in India. And, you know, I guess the best way to explain the creation of the Khalsa, more than 200 years after Guru Nanak's life, is to say that it represents the full genetic expression of the Sikh DNA. So, the creation of the Khalsa in 1699 by our 10th Guru represents really a consolidation of the teachings and the principles of the first Guru, Guru Nanak. And those teachings were that there is one God, that all people are equal. There's a great deal of emphasis in the Sikh religious tradition on equality, universal equality among all human beings. And there's also a great deal of emphasis on social justice. So, As Sikh children, we're often taught that the three principles of the Sikh religion, as taught by Guru Nanak and the other gurus, are that there is one God, that we should always remember God, that we should earn an honest living with our own labor, and that we should share our earnings with the less fortunate. We should be charitable. And, you know, that can be interpreted to mean that we should be involved with social justice movements. Charity just isn't a matter of giving people money. It's also giving your time and giving people who are being oppressed the power to be able to stand on their own two feet. So these are principles which are core to the Sikh DNA and which were set forth and really inaugurated by Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh religion. But as the Sikh population grew under the leadership of the gurus, we increasingly became the targets of persecution by the Mughal Empire, which ruled over India over the course of centuries. And as I said before, our fifth guru, Guru Arjan, was executed by the Mughal Empire because he was seen as a threat to them. And the message of Sikhism, its egalitarian message, its message of openness and pluralism and democracy was seen as a threat. And of course, our ninth guru, Guru Tegh Bahadur, was also arrested and executed by the Mughal Empire for standing up for religious freedom. Now, when Guru Tegh Bahadur, the ninth guru, was executed by order of the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb in 1675, you know, you can imagine the effect that had on the psyche of ordinary people. And in that context, Guru Gobind Singh, our final guru, tenth guru, decided that in the face of this persecution, it would not be wise to sort of hide our identity or to kind of tone the message down of the Sikh religion. Rather, his approach was to amplify the Sikh identity and make it, in a way, more conspicuous as a target of persecution. And so what he did was, in 1699, in the spring, he called a congregation of his followers in a place called Anandpur in Punjab, India. And he had arranged for a stage and had pitched a tent, a very large tent, and he approached his followers, he addressed his followers and said, with a drawn sword in his hand, "I need one of my Sikhs to sacrifice their life for the faith." And those in the congregation were terrified and aghast. They didn't know what was going on. But finally, after some time, one of them stood up and said, "I will volunteer myself." So this individual was taken behind the tent, behind this enclosure. And after some time, Guru Gobind Singh emerged alone, again with a drawn sword, which appeared to be covered with blood. And, you know, at this stage, people were aghast and terrified. Many actually fled. But he issued his call. He said, "I need another one of my Sikhs to sacrifice themselves for the faith." And the process was repeated a total of five times. Five volunteers stepped forward, and they were taken to the back of this enclosure. After the fifth, the guru, Guru Gobind Singh, reappeared with all of them, who were freshly dressed, wearing the five articles of the Sikh faith, which I'll explain in a moment. And he declared that these Sikhs forever would be known as the five beloved ones. We call them the Panj Pyare. That they were the only people in this massive crowd to be willing to conquer their fear and lay down their lives for their faith. And this had an electrifying effect on the Sikh community. And really what it represented was kind of a declaration of Sikh sovereignty in the face of persecution. And what Guru Gobind Singh required his Khalsa, these new initiates into this new fellowship of devout Sikhs, to do was wear certain articles of faith on their person at all times to signal to the public their commitment to core Sikh ideals. So all members of the Khalsa and people who aspire to be members of this fellowship wear turbans. The turban signifies a commitment to core Sikh ideals. It's sort of it's worn as a reminder to live up to the Sikh ideals that were taught by the Sikh gurus, from Guru Nanak to Guru Gobind Singh. But it's also a symbol of nobility and sovereignty. A turban is essentially a crown. And so in the context of the persecution that was going on in India at that time, you know, when the ninth guru himself had been executed, this was a way of saying to the Mughal Empire, you know, "We're not going to hide our identity. We're going to amplify it. And in fact, we're going to wear symbols of political status and sovereignty and issue a challenge to you and say, you know, we can't hide. You can come and kill us if you want, and persecute us if you want, but we've conquered our fear, and you know we're not going to allow ourselves to be subjected to tyranny. So that's really what the turban represents. It represents that a Sikh is an ambassador of his or her faith, and that they stand for certain ideals and convictions, and they can't hide from those convictions. They have to hold themselves accountable and strive to live an ethical life without fear of any kind of persecution. So that's the turban. It's still an integral part of the Sikh identity, and the one that is most evident when people meet Sikhs. But there are also five other articles of faith that Guru Gobind Singh required his Khalsa to wear. They are colloquially known as the five Ks, because in the Punjabi language, all of them start with our equivalent of the letter K. One of them is called Kesh. Kesh is uncut hair. And Sikhs maintain uncut hair. Observant, devout Sikhs maintain uncut hair, partly because it's part of our religious uniform. It, again, amplifies our appearance and signals to the world that we are Sikhs and that we stand for certain values. But I think it also signifies a belief that the body is sacrosanct in its completeness. The idea, roughly, is that the body is creation of God and that you should not tamper with the way the body works naturally. And Sikhs are required to maintain uncut hair. You know, people often ask us, well, you know, that's interesting, but I think it's actually unremarkable because all people are born with hair. And in fact, people who cut their hair are the ones who are tampering with the body. So I don't think keeping uncut hair is remarkable. But anyway, uncut hair, kesh. Sikhs are also required to wear a small wooden comb or keep a small wooden comb in their hair called a kanga. A kanga is an article of faith that signifies or represents cleanliness. So in practical terms, it's not just used to comb the hair. It also is a reminder that we have to keep ourselves physically clean, but also spiritually clean. The other article of faith is a kara. A kara is a steel bangle, which is worn around the wrist. And it's a reminder, again, to lead an ethical life. You know, I often tell my friends that it's sort of like a wedding ring. You know, it's worn on your body to remind you of your commitment to your spouse. And similarly, the kara is worn, like the other articles of faith, as a reminder of your commitment to God, to live an ethical life. And the other article of faith is called a kachera. Kachera are cotton undershorts, kind of like underwear, which, again, represent or signify the importance of sexual fidelity, ethical behavior. Sikhs are required to live the life of a householder. So even the most devout Sikhs are forbidden from renouncing the world. They have to live a family life, and they have to participate in the rough and tumble of the world. But the kachera is a reminder of the importance of living an ethical life in the context of a monogamous marriage. And finally, Sikhs who are members of the Khalsa, who are initiates into this fellowship, are required to wear a kirpan. A kirpan is an article of faith that resembles a small sword, and it is a reminder to Sikhs that they have an obligation, a moral obligation, to stand up, speak out against tyranny, against injustice, and to do so in memory of the gurus who, in many cases, laid down their own lives in the cause of human rights. And so it literally means, kirpan actually literally means instrument of mercy or an instrument of justice, and it's never to be used offensively. It is a reminder that we have an obligation when all other peaceful means of resolving conflict have failed, that we have an obligation to fight against injustice and to stand up and speak up against all forms of tyranny. So these articles of faith and the turban collectively sort of are an externalization of the Sikh identity and the Sikh value system. They're not mere symbols. They have a great deal of spiritual, religious significance. They're worn as reminders of our religious and ethical obligations, and we wear them as instructed by Guru Gobind Singh, our 10th prophet. And I should tell you a little bit more about what happened, what transpired in 1699. After this spectacle where five Sikhs proved their courage, their fearlessness to the Guru inaugurated an initiation ceremony. What he did was he poured water into a steel bowl and poured sugar into it and mixed it with a double-edged dagger. So, you know, you think about steel and what it represents. Steel represents strength, courage, the qualities of a soldier. Sweetness represents the qualities of a saint, you know, someone who's compassionate, someone who's soft-spoken, who organizes their life around mercy. Guru Gobind Singh created this, you can say it's kind of like baptismal water, although it's not strictly speaking a baptism, but he called it Amrit. And he had his five followers, his five beloved ones, as he called them, drink from this bowl. And then he asked them to administer Amrit to them, and he drank from the bowl. And he said that anyone who goes through this initiation ceremony from now on is now a member of the Khalsa. All male initiates have to take the name Singh, which means lion, and all women initiates have to take the name Kaur, that's spelled K-A-U-R, Kaur, which means princess or lioness. And the reason that's significant is because in the context of the caste system in India, which is an extremely discriminatory social stratification system, which relegates people to lives of poverty and disadvantage based on organized superstitions. The reason why this is significant is by eliminating people's birth names and giving them the common name Singh and the common name Kaur, Guru Gobind Singh sought to eradicate the caste system. This is a practical way of getting rid of a discriminatory social institution, and that is expressed in the way that Sikhs are named. And so even today, you can readily identify Sikhs by their common surname Singh or Kaur if they're women. In fact, Sikh women are not required to take the name of their husband. They retain the name Kaur. And there's another layer of meaning here because, you know, those names, again, kind of connote political status and sovereignty. It's very empowering for somebody to have the name Lion or to have the name Lioness or Princess. There's a lot of responsibility and obligation that attaches to carrying those names. So Guru Gobind Singh essentially tried to, as I said before, give full genetic expression to the Sikh DNA, to give full consolidated expression to the teachings of his predecessors, starting from Guru Nanak onward. And that's the story of the creation of the Khalsa. Not all Sikhs are members of the Khalsa. Not all Sikhs are initiated. But, you know, on the continuum of religious orthodoxy, people are on different stages of their spiritual journey. So some people are ready to make the commitment to live an ethical life and to maintain the five articles of faith. They are initiated into the Khalsa. Others are working towards that. They're working towards that ideal. And so although not all Sikhs are members of the Khalsa, a great number of Sikhs still wear turbans and maintain uncut hair, even if they don't maintain the other articles of faith.
Now, these articles of faith make you stand out, and as you mentioned in the history, this is part and parcel of why they were introduced. And coming into America, you are, as a minority community, going to stand out here. And the next step in the conversation here I'm interested in is how Sikh Americans have fit in, let's say, since about 1965 until present? How have they integrated into the American society? Have Americans been relatively welcoming of the community, et cetera? Give us some idea about that.
I think in general, Sikhs are doing very well in the United States, but there are still some profound challenges. And we've seen this most acutely since 9/11. So I think the prevailing stereotype these days is that if somebody wears a turban, they're associated with Al-Qaeda. And in fact, after 9/11, most of us here in the States, you know, saw images of Osama bin Laden blaring from our TV screens constantly, day and night, 24/7. And I think that has been the root of a lot of the challenges that Sikhs face in the United States. So my organization, the Sikh Coalition, has conducted a number of surveys around the country, civil rights assessments, to determine what kinds of challenges Sikhs continue to face. And there's several. In some cities, something like 67% of Sikh children are bullied because of their religion, specifically because of the way they look. And in addition to that, in some cities, almost 10% of Sikhs believe that they have been subjected to employment discrimination, job discrimination, again, because of the way they look, because of their turbans and beards, and because of their kirpans in some cases. Sikhs are also subjected to profiling, invidious profiling by law enforcement. So a number of Sikhs have complained to us that they're set aside for disparate or discriminatory screening at American airports, again, because of the way they look. And finally, in sort of the worst-case scenarios, Sikhs have been assaulted, and many have actually lost their lives in hate crimes, again, because of the way they look, because of their turbans, because of their sort of external sort of articles of faith. So these challenges, school bullying, job discrimination, invidious profiling, hate crimes, are the principal challenges facing Sikhs in the United States. And so although a lot of Sikhs are doing very well economically, a lot of them are leading successful lives as business people, as CEOs, as lawyers and doctors and so forth, there's still a lot of Sikhs who are struggling and who are subjected to discrimination that we thought would have been addressed by, say, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There is still a lot of 101 level discrimination happening against Sikhs in the workplace, which is a big, big problem these days, not to mention the other challenges that I had listed out earlier.
And including one that became very manifest just about a year ago in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, a horrible incident where a number of Sikhs were massacred, which is very sad.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. I just want to, you know, give your listeners something to think about. The August 5th, 2012 massacre of Sikh worshippers at a Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, led to the loss of six lives, led to several people being injured, in some cases permanently. In fact, there is one Sikh named Punjab Singh who's still in a kind of a coma, even now, because of injuries he sustained during that attack. And that assault on the Sikh Gurdwara by a neo-Nazi in Wisconsin, in terms of loss of life, was the worst, most lethal attack on an American place of worship since the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Mm-hmm. Now, the 16th Street Baptist Church is something we all learn about in middle school and high school history class. It galvanized support for the civil rights movement. And it remains to be seen whether Oak Creek will be remembered similarly and whether it will be treated or regarded as a turning point for religious pluralism, religious freedom, non-discrimination, and civil rights here in the United States in our lifetimes.
And that's the issue I want to turn to next, because you have dealt with a number of cases that deal with religious discrimination and with the issues of religious liberty, a very big hot button topic today. And you were instrumental in one of these cases in a state just south of me, which is in Oregon, that dealt with the issue of religious attire. Discuss this case and, you know, put it in the context of also, you know, the Sikh attire and how important it is to the religion, because I think these things blend together very well.
Yeah, so, you know, the Sikh articles of faith, which are required to be worn by devout Sikhs, as per the instructions of the founders of our faith, are integral parts of the Sikh identity. So take the turban, for example. The turban is not like a hat. You know, it's not something that could just be taken off at will, at the discretion of an employer. It is a part of a Sikh's body, essentially. Devout Sikhs would rather lose their job rather than remove their turban. And historically speaking, in the face of Mughal persecution, you know, Sikhs often chose to die than to remove their turbans and be subjected to the ignominy of having their hair forcibly cut, for example. So people need to understand that, you know, the Sikh articles of faith are non-negotiable. They are an integral part of the Sikh identity. They are a source of self-definition for Sikhs. And in the workplace, in most instances, legally speaking, employers really don't have a good justification for discriminating against Sikhs because they wear turbans or because they maintain beards. In the state of Oregon, for example, for 87 years, from 1923 till about 2010, the state government prohibited public school teachers from wearing any kind of religious dress in Oregon public schools. And this was actually a measure that was hatched by sympathizers of the Ku Klux Klan in Oregon at the height of the nativist movement in the United States. We spoke earlier about restrictive, racist immigration laws that stopped immigration from Asia to the United States. There was a great deal of anti-Asian violence at that time, particularly around the West Coast of the United States, but there was also a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment at that time. And in 1923, the Oregon legislature passed a law that was designed to shut Catholics out of education in the state of Oregon. And what they did initially was they closed down the private school. They said that we're not going to recognize your schooling unless it's done through the public school. So that was aimed at the Catholic schools. And to prevent the nuns and priests from coming into the public schools, they passed another measure that said teachers in Oregon cannot wear any kind of religious dress. Now, that law survived well into the 20th century, and it wasn't challenged until 1986 in the Oregon Supreme Court. It was actually challenged by a Sikh, a teacher who had converted to the Sikh religion but who was fired for wearing a turban. Unfortunately, she lost. The Oregon Supreme Court acknowledged that the law in question had dubious origins, but they maintained it. They sustained it, nevertheless, in the name of religious neutrality. What they argued was that the First Amendment requires the separation of church and state, and because public school teachers are working in the public square, essentially, we don't want to subject impressionable students to religious indoctrination, even if it's unconscious. And so that was the reason why the Oregon Supreme Court denied Sikhs and other religious minorities, including Muslims and Jews, functionally, the right to teach in Oregon public schools.
This is one of those, I just have to interrupt here, because this is one of these laws and these cases I end up scratching my head because I'm kind of amazed that anybody in 1986 would be even concerned about this law. It'd be one of those books or one of those laws that, you know, was created 100 years ago. You know, your horse shouldn't spit on the side of the, you know, road while, you know, bringing your cart in with your pigs or something like that, right? And these are funny laws that were passed a long time ago, but everybody forgets about. But all of a sudden, it became an issue in 1986.
It did. And unfortunately, the law was given a new lease on life in the name of religious neutrality. And it wasn't until 2009 that an organization that I was working for got involved and really sort of spearheaded an effort to get the law repealed. What happened was, in 2009, the state of Oregon passed another law called the Workplace Religious Freedom Act. WRFA is its acronym. And in most respects, it's a very good law because it makes it harder for employers to fire or refuse to hire religious observers because of things like religious dress, religious garb. But ironically, the Workplace Religious Freedom Act had an exception in it for public school teachers. And it said that this law will not override our existing law prohibiting public school teachers from exercising their religious freedom. So I felt deeply aggrieved by this. You know, a state legislature was passing a law in the name of religious freedom, but at the same time denying it to an entire class of Oregonians. So at that time, we wrote a letter to Oregon's governor, and we asked him to veto it, to veto the Workplace Religious Freedom Act until it was sort of faithfully kind of reintroduced so that all people would enjoy religious freedom. I think we characterized the exception as a gaping hole. We then approached the Oregon legislature and worked with a number of interfaith organizations, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, to finally get that law repealed through the legislative process. And, you know, what we said was two things. We said the Ku Klux Klan shouldn't be dictating our civil rights in the 21st century. You know, America's moved on, and it's a shame that their legacy is still on the books and being enforced against people who are just trying to earn an honest living. But with respect to the religious neutrality argument, what we said was that there's a distinction between religious messaging, proselytizing, overt indoctrination, preaching, and so forth. There's a difference between that, those kinds of activities and wearing religious dress in private adherence to faith. And we pointed out that there are Sikh teachers and Jewish teachers and Muslim teachers throughout the United States who work without any kind of issue, whose students, in some cases, score higher than their peers on standardized tests, and, you know, who are obviously doing a good job. And we pointed out that in these circumstances, you know, what a teacher believes and the kind of dress that they wear really has no bearing on their ability to, you know, teach math or geography or English or whatever, right? I mean, it has nothing to do with their core job function. And overwhelmingly, the Oregon legislature agreed with us, and I'm proud to say that the Sikh American community, in alliance with other interfaith groups, was able to get this law, which was originally aimed at Catholics, but in our time, disproportionately impacts Jews, Muslims, and Sikhs, finally repealed. And, you know, I think that illustrates that in most instances, how we look really has no bearing on the kind of work we do. And so for that reason, policies that prohibit Sikhs and other religious minorities from working based on their appearance are in our view bogus. I mean, they really don't have any kind of rational grounding. And unfortunately, though, a lot of employers don't agree.
Let me ask about some line drawing here as well, too, because in my class on religion and politics in the past, I've often introduced a court case that was in Canada, you know, maybe about a decade or so ago now, that involved Sikhs and involved workplace safety. And it was, there's a regulation that says if you're in a construction site, you have to wear a hard hat because you don't want steel beams falling on top of your head. And that's very important. But the problem with the turban is it made it very difficult to fit a hard hat on. Most pre-existing hard hats don't fit on it. And even if you try to construct one, it makes it a little bit difficult. It doesn't fit in quite the regulations. And earlier you mentioned before that in terms of the religious attire that Sikhs wear and many other people wear. They, you know, sometimes have to not take jobs because of those things. So in the case of the school teacher wearing, you know, religious garb, yeah, it doesn't seem like that's a big health and safety issue or anything like that. But what about one of those cases that came up in Canada?
It's a great question. And really that goes to the heart of the law that I mentioned earlier, the Workplace Religious Freedom Act. As you know, under federal law, employers are required to make a reasonable accommodation of someone's religion unless doing so would impose an undue hardship on the employer. And this is a balancing test. Every case has to be analyzed on the basis of its own unique facts and circumstances, and you may not get the same answer all the time. And so although it is true that in the retail context, you know, where I want to work at Abercrombie, for example, and I'm being told that I can't wear a turban, there really isn't any kind of rational relationship between me wearing a turban and my ability to sell clothes. You know, although there are cases like that, and also the case of the school teachers in Oregon, as you point out, there may be cases where, because of someone's job functions, they may not be able to have it both ways. And I think, in general, we agree. So one example that I like to give, which I kind of give half-jokingly, is, you know, I, as a Sikh, cannot expect to work as a Gillette model, you know, like a spokesperson for the Gillette shaving company, right? For obvious reasons, because I don't cut my hair. Similarly, you know, I cannot, as a Sikh, who wears a turban and a beard, be cast in the role of Cinderella, you know, in some kind of Disney production. We get that. That's not discrimination, but that's not the point. I think the point is, what do you do in the gray area cases where, for example, someone has to wear a hard hat or a gas mask? Well, with respect to hard hats, most people may not know this, but OSHA, the federal agency that deals with workplace safety issues and so forth, has actually issued a directive. They issued this some time ago, which allows religious observers to wear religious head coverings in lieu of hard hats. You know, there is sort of a notice process, and permission has to be granted by the employer, but basically OSHA has said that they're not going to impose any kind of liability on an employer for making a reasonable religious accommodation for a religious observer like a Sikh who wears a turban. Now, some Sikhs, in accordance with their own sort of religious interpretation and based on their own comfort level and conscience, wear smaller turbans underneath helmets when helmets are required in like a military setting. So we're actually struggling to persuade the U.S. military to allow Sikhs to serve because of these kinds of issues. But as it turns out, most Sikhs who serve in the armed forces throughout the world, including India, Canada, Great Britain, and even our U.S. Army in some limited circumstances, in operational settings, in combat settings, will wear smaller turbans under helmets. You know, when Sikhs in the 18th century were literally battling for their survival in the face of persecution, they also wore protective gear to protect their bodies in the context of warfare. So, you know, Sikhs are reasonable people, but, you know, we also need to understand that the law gives Sikhs an opportunity in many instances to kind of negotiate or navigate these workplace requirements and are actually supported by federal law in the case of helmets. Now, in the case of gas masks, oftentimes there's a misunderstanding between employers and Sikh employees. We had to file a lawsuit several years ago against the state of California because they were not allowing a Sikh to work as a corrections officer with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And the whole dispute centered around his beard, ostensibly, purportedly. And they were denying him the ability to test out the gas mask and prove that he was able to wear it in compliance with safety requirements. And the reason I said there's a lot of misunderstanding is because a lot of employers may not be aware, a lot of people generally may not be aware, that devout observant Sikhs, while they don't cut their hair or their beards, often groom and tie up their beards to give it kind of like a form-fitting, kind of close-cropped appearance. So Sikhs in the U.S. military, Sikhs in armed forces throughout the world, Sikhs who work in industry, laboratories, correctional settings, usually tie their beards up to accommodate a gas mask. And oftentimes, in these sorts of cases and circumstances, the employers just make an armchair assumption about whether someone with a beard can wear a gas mask, without even giving these employees an opportunity to demonstrate that they can wear gas masks safely. And moreover, in terms of technology, there's plenty of technology now that allows people, even with full flowing beards and other kind of religious garb, to wear hooded gas masks, you know, whole body respiratory apparatus, and so on. So I think the key in a lot of these employment cases is just dialogue and information and overcoming ignorance and educating employers and prospective employers about Sikh religious practices and going into great detail about how Sikhs groom their beards, how they tie their turbans, what kinds of turbans they do wear, because they're different styles. But our position as an organization is that religious freedom should be given the benefit of the doubt, and it should be given due deference. And unless it is plainly impossible for someone to discharge their job obligations and also their religious obligations, religious accommodations should be made. And in fact, that's what federal law requires.
Yeah, kind of like your whole points about, you know, first of all, technology makes some of these questions moot at points in time, but also the other instance of negotiation and flexibility and the religious liberty laws that you've been working to, you know, that you've been lobbying for have really allowed for more of that negotiation instead of strict bureaucratic rules. You get people to say, okay, listen, here, this religious garb is rather important to me, and I'm willing to accept the liability in this case and that. And it allows, I think, people to come together a lot easier via more flexible understandings of one another.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, I also want to make another larger point, which is oftentimes Sikhs and other religious minorities are, in a way, accused of being different and seem to shoulder the burden of having to justify why they are different. But objectively speaking, there's nothing more or less different about the way I dress than the way you dress or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Abercrombie and other employers, including the U.S. military and the NYPD, both of whom restrict the right of Sikhs to serve with the uniformed services, the reason why they're able to enforce these restrictive grooming or image policies is because, frankly, they're the ones writing the rules. If the population of Sikhs in this country was more substantial, or if we lived in like a Sikh-majority state, there would be no question that Sikhs should be allowed to wear a turban and maintain uncut hair. It wouldn't be regarded as kind of unusual or bizarre or weird or different or something like that. I think there's a very annoying tendency on the part of employers and decision makers in any kind of majoritarian society to write rules that have certain into them about what is normal and what is not, but nevertheless, these rules are passed on as objective and neutral and, you know, kind of scientifically airtight and rational.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in most instances, I would tell an employer, and especially in the retail sector or the law enforcement sector, that there's nothing objective about their rules. There's nothing fair or neutral about a rule that says you can't have a beard because a beard is unprofessional. You know, there's nothing neutral, objective, or fair about a rule that says you can't wear a turban because a turban is somehow, you know, unusual or unprofessional. I think what's required is a more holistic, pluralistic approach to religion and religious accommodation in this country, and I think a fuller definition of what an American is and what an American should look like.
I think that's a really good point to make, and I want to echo that clearly. And you've done a number of other great things in terms of working for these types of religious liberty laws and greater interfaith and intercultural understandings in California and a few other places. And unfortunately, we're running out of time and we won't be able to talk about all those things. But there is a question that I always like to have my guests reflect upon in terms of, you know, what they've been doing over the past decade or two decades in their own scholarship and their own work. And I think this is a really nice place here. You've done a lot of work with religious liberty, with religious accommodation, with interfaith dialogue, intercultural dialogues. For you, looking at this point in time in American history and coming from the Sikh community, do you think things are getting better or worse for the Sikh community here in America and for religious minorities in general? And what's your general perspective on the future? Are you fairly optimistic, fairly pessimistic? Where are you sitting?
Well, I think by nature, Sikhs are optimists. There's an idea, a religious concept in our tradition, a catchphrase called Chardi Kala, which means high spirits. And we're religiously required to maintain a positive outlook on life, never to give up, even in the face of tall odds and challenges. But I think the future of religious liberty is still up for grabs, I'm sorry to say. We've seen the worst sort of forms of intolerance and religious persecution throughout history, and even in our own time. Think of ISIS in the Middle East and their approach to religious freedom. That's not something that exists in their vocabulary. There are a number of countries in the world today that enforce blasphemy laws that, in their very essence, are kind of anti-freedom, anti-religious pluralism. But there are also some offenders in countries that are more familiar to us. So think of France. In France, it is illegal for Sikhs and also observant Jews and Muslims to wear religious garb in the public schools. It's illegal for them to wear a religious garb if they are state employees. It's still something that's being debated in European courts, but as of now, or at least until recently, observant members of these religious traditions were not allowed to obtain ID cards, photo identification, unless they remove their religious garb. And all this is being done in the name of secularism and religious neutrality, but I think I reject those excuses. Again, this is just sort of an imposition of majoritarian norms and majoritarian will on hapless religious minorities. We often think of, you know, Pakistan and Iran and Saudi Arabia, where we think of the Religious Freedom Hall of Shame, and for good reason. But I think we need to add countries like France to those lists. Now, I think in the United States, we're better off than in many other parts of the world. Even in the 20th century, Sikhs have experienced brutal persecution in India, our historic homeland, because of political grievances that Sikhs have with the central government there. So I think if you think of safe havens for Sikhs, the places where it's most likely that Sikhs will be able to flourish without any kind of persecution, I definitely would put the United States on that list, but, we can't be complacent. I've mentioned to you several challenges that Sikhs face in this country. Our children are being bullied at rates which are suggestive of an epidemic. Sikhs are often subjected to hate crime, and more often than not, Sikhs are subjected to, if not workplace discrimination, then, maybe a kind of apprehension. The Sikh identity isn't sort of fully integrated into the American sort of public consciousness. I mean, if I were to ask you to define an American, or if I were to, ask an American schoolchild to draw a picture of an American or a group of Americans, I'd be willing to bet that they wouldn't think of a turbaned Sikh. And I think until that dynamic changes, we still have work to do. And as long as the Sikh community continues to play a leadership role in struggles for religious freedom, as we have in places like Oregon, in California, where we passed workplace religious freedom legislation, then I think over time the profile of Sikhs will be more obvious, more visible to average Americans. And I look forward to the day when a Sikh can run for the governorship of an American state, or the U.S. Congress, or even the presidency, and people don't bat an eye. I think that's really the ideal for us in this country.
And I think that's an ideal that I share as well, and it's a nice way to end off our conversation with today. My guest has been Rajib Singh of the Sikh Coalition. Raj, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.